In this hour of Focus 580, we'll be talking about Iraq and try to get a better understanding of what is going on there today by looking back to the last time a Western power tried to create a democratic nation in the state of Iraq. And we're talking about the experience of the British in the 20s and the 30s. Our guest this morning, Toby Dodge, has written a book on this. It's titled Inventing Iraq, The Failure of Nation Building and a History Denied, and it is published by the Columbia University Press. And in this book, he makes the argument that there are parallels between the place we find ourselves now in this country, in Iraq, and the experience of the British back in the 20s and 30s, that we're encountering some of the same kinds of forces. And in fact, he makes the argument that if the United States is not careful, it will make some of the same mistakes that the British made and ultimately have no more success than the British did. If you're interested in reading and on this subject in some depth, you certainly can go and look for that book. And here on this program, questions are welcome. 333-9455 is the Champaign-Urbana number. We do also have a toll-free line that's good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. Let me just tell you a little bit more about our guest. Toby Dodge is a senior research fellow at the Center for the Study of Globalization at the University of Warwick in England. He's also an associate fellow of the Royal Institute of International Affairs in London. He's acted as a consultant on Iraq for ABC News. He's also written for The Guardian. He is in Chicago today and is talking with us from there. Dr. Dodge, hello.
Hi, it's a pleasure to be with you.
Well, we appreciate very much you giving us some of your time. Let's talk a little bit about the British experience in Iraq. Obviously, in your book, you go into it in great depth, so what we're going to just have to give people this morning here is kind of the big picture. But I think the basic themes are pretty clear and do indeed give us something to think about as we look at the experience of the United States. And basically here what we're talking about is going back to the time, this is after World War I. This was a territory that had been part of the Ottoman Empire that was acquired by the British as a result of the war, and that there were these three provinces, names that are now familiar to people, Mosul, Baghdad, and Basra, decided to take them and mold them into one country and try to create a nation. It seems that part of the problem here for the British was that they came to Iraq not knowing much about Iraqi society and having ideas about it that simply weren't right.
That's exactly right. I think the story starts a week after the Ottoman Empire came into the First World War on the side of Germany. Britain invaded what was to become Iraq through Basra, the port town at the very south of the country, and then fought its way up to Baghdad. Now, fascinatingly, in 1917, General Moore, the British general who seized Baghdad, announced that the British forces came as liberators, not conquerors, that they were here to help the Iraqi people help themselves. They were here to help the Iraqis build a liberal democratic state. So there was there are strong similarities with today. Regime change was done in the name of efficient government, in the name of the Iraqi people. But from 1917 to 1920, nothing much changed. The British controlled the country, but weren't doing much, and increasing resentment built up. The Iraqis got very dissatisfied. And in July 1920, again with strong contemporary parallels, a revolt broke out across the whole of the country and lasted until February 1921. It took 2,000 casualties and £40 million, a great deal of money then, to suppress. Now, I think this was the turning point for the British occupation of Iraq. The British public, at the end of a grueling First World War, suddenly woke up to the fact that British troops were dying in a country they'd never heard of. And I asked, why are we there? What on earth are the British doing there? And a few years later, an election in Britain was fought on the basis of Iraq. And the coalition government of Lloyd George and Winston Churchill were thrown out of power, and the Prime Minister who was elected, Bonar Law, was elected on the slogan, "We cannot be the policemen of the world." Now, this then becomes the crucial moment. From 1920 onwards, the British politicians and civil service realize that they can't hold Iraq indefinitely, that electoral politics in Britain won't allow them to. So they start cutting corners. They start trying to find Iraqis within Iraqi society who can take the state over. Who can they give the state to? Who can they offload this troublesome burden onto? And I think that's when British misperceptions come to dominate, that as they move through Iraqi society, they're trying to identify a group of Iraqis who have social influence, who can persuade the population that the British occupation is a good thing, and who ultimately they can give the state to, and that's their great failing.
Hmm. It's interesting that the British seem to have this odd sort of way of looking at Iraqi society. They had this idea that people who lived in the country were somehow more pure than people who lived in the cities, and perhaps also they thought that the place where they're likely to have the most trouble is in urban areas. So they had this preference for this leaning towards the country and the people, the sheikhs who ruled, or so to speak, at various places around the country. And so that's where they threw their lot in. They threw their lot in with those peoples because either they thought that they would that they could work with them more easily, or that they would end up with a better state or a better kind of government if they used those people, and created a division that perhaps didn't really exist in Iraqi society, but in the minds of the British did exist.
Yeah, there was a fundamental misunderstanding about Iraqi society, and there are many reasons for this. First, as you say, that there is in British culture, and certainly in British culture in the 1920s, a kind of a worship of all things rural. Mm-hmm. The countryside in Britain, but across the world, was seen as to hold the essence of decency, and the cities were seen as polluted and corrupting. Now, if we add on to that a British passion for all things tribal, that the tribal sheikh in British folklore became the personification of a gentleman that was called to higher things than grubby politics. Now, again, what reinforced this perception of Iraq, this faulty perception of Iraq, was an understanding of the Ottoman Empire as corrupt and corrupting, a despotic dictatorship based in the cities, based on urban individuals who would spread disunity and violence within Iraqi society. So the ramifications of this were profound and very damaging. That what had actually happened was the British had no chance to do any sustained research into Iraq, to understand Iraqi dynamics. Again, this is understandable because they hadn't been able to get into Iraq while it was ruled under the Ottoman Empire in any great numbers or for any great length of time. And secondly, once they seized Iraq, because money was so short, they had no great time to do a census, to do a land survey, to get to know the country in any detail. So that they didn't realize that during the 1800s, Iraq had been radically transformed. Now, if we keep in mind that the 1800s were a period of intense free trade, probably a freer international economy than we have today, and Iraq had been slowly integrated into that system, exporting grain and rice through the port of Basra. Now, this transformed social dynamics in Iraq. Land became very, very valuable and had a price attached to it, and the tribal sheikhs set out to seize that land for themselves. So they took it away from tribespeople and registered it in their own names and farmed it, turning their tribespeople into little less than serfs, being kept on the land by the force of violence, being kept on the land as in very, very poor situations. So the British, when they went into Iraq, thought they were finding noble representatives of wider tribal society, the first among equals, gentlemen who they could rely on to act as a conduit for British power into Iraqi society, but also who could deliver large numbers of the Iraqi population. They were fundamentally wrong. So it's that misconception, that misunderstanding of Iraqi society that undermined the evolution of the state in Iraq.
Mm. Well, it's also interesting to another sort of parallel to where we are today, this decision by Winston Churchill at the point where there was increasing pressure in Britain to pull troops from Iraq, this idea that he could and the British could maintain control by using air power, by using airplanes.
Yeah, I mean, this is the fascinating quirk of history. It's shock and awe is the buzzword of the Iraqi war in April now, or in March and April now. Shock and awe, the use of aeroplanes to police populations, the use of aeroplanes to impose order, as you say, was invented by Winston Churchill in Iraq as a way of cutting costs, but also as a way of imposing order on a population without losing large numbers of British troops. So again, there are very strong parallels with the United States Air Force today bombing the Sunni Triangle, bombing Tikrit and the surroundings on the basis that it's easier to bomb a population into submission than it is to send troops in, because the troops will die and that will be politically unpopular at home.
Let me introduce again, just very quickly, our guest. For anyone who has tuned in, we're talking with Toby Dodge. He is a senior research fellow at the Center for the Study of Globalization at University of Warwick in the UK. He's also an associate fellow of the Royal Institute of International Affairs in London, and is here spending some time in the United States talking about Iraq and some of the parallels between the period where Britain was involved in Iraq. This was in the 20s and 30s, and the place that we are now. And if you're interested in reading some of this history, you can look for his book, which is titled Inventing Iraq, The Failure of Nation Building and a History Denied. It is published by Columbia University Press. Today he is in Chicago. Questions here on the program are welcome, 333-9455. And we do also have a toll-free line. That's good anywhere you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. We do have some callers here getting lined up, and the first is in Champaign. On line one. Hello.
Good morning.
Yes.
Two questions, one general, one specific. Specifically, wasn't the case that Winston Churchill also justified the use of poison gas by the circumstances in Iraq, that the British, who had experience with it during the Great War, now were willing to use it to pacify their Iraqi provinces? Second one, would you say something about the question of oil politics? This seems to me one of the major differences between the American and British occupations. For America today, oil is clearly at the forefront of consideration. I have the impression that in the 20s, the oil riches of Iraq were either unknown or uncared about by the British.
Yeah, two very good questions. I think I've spent too much of the last decade in British archives sifting through all the paperwork of the occupation of Iraq. Now, this is a very controversial and powerful point about Winston Churchill's telling the Royal Air Force to experiment with bombing the Kurds, actually, with poison gas. I found no evidence that that actually took place. What I found, and what this possible myth is based upon, was a telegram sent by Churchill to Baghdad saying, maybe we should experiment with poison gas, and it was decided not to, as far as I can understand. I've found no definitive proof of that. And you've got to keep in mind that the use of air power in Iraq was deeply, deeply unpopular in Britain. Many questions asked in Parliament, a lot of public unease, because it was seen as both technologically extremely advanced and very unfair and damaging. So Winston Churchill and the Royal Air Force was very much constrained by popular opinion, and either had to lie, as they frequently did, about the use of bombing, for example, to get the Iraqi population to pay tax, or to be restrained by popular opinion and not use it. So I don't think there is evidence of poison gas use, though it was certainly suggested by Churchill. On the second issue of oil, yes, indeed. At the end of the First World War, the British Navy fleet, the Royal Navy, was using coal and only slowly switching to oil. And so oil, to begin with, wasn't the dominant issue in Iraq. But as oil came on stream and the economic power of oil became apparent, then oil politics did come to influence the occupation. But I agree with you, wasn't the major impetus. Now, let me be a bit controversial and disagree with you on oil today. I think clearly, oil is an influential factor, but I don't think it's the dominant one. as now we've discovered that weapons of mass destruction aren't either the dominant one. I think after 9/11, and indeed in the run-up to 9/11, George Bush's neoconservative advisors looked out at the developing world, and they saw from the developing world the main threat to American interest, the main threat to America through the use of asymmetrical warfare. So they came up with this argument that the right to sovereignty in the post-colonial world had to be earned by meeting a certain set of responsibilities, that states in the developing world can't develop weapons of mass destruction, they can't support terrorism or asymmetrical warfare, take your term, whichever you feel more comfortable with, and they can't, and they must have transparency in banking and finance agreements. So if you think what the neoconservatives and George Bush were trying to do was change the terms of international politics in the aftermath of 9/11, and as they strove to do that, there was one country, Iraq, who had thumbed its nose, who turned its back on international convention since 1990-91 and the invasion of Kuwait, and had survived near continuous aerial bombing since that time and the harshest sanctions ever imposed. So I think George Bush's people decided that they had to get regime change in Iraq to signal to the rest of the developing world how serious they were about the Bush Doctrine, how serious they were about demanding certain things from states in return for sovereignty. So oil played a role, but wasn't the crucial defining role, I think, in the invasion of Iraq.
I think you have a far too generous reading of the Bush administration's motives, but as far as oil is concerned, it seems to me that has been at the center of American foreign policy, at least since the Second World War. I mean, it was the Eisenhower administration that referred to Mideast oil as the world's greatest geopolitical prize. It seems to me that what the U.S. is doing in its control of Iraq is controlling worldwide energy resources against its real enemies, its real economic enemies, which is Europe and Northeast Asia. But as far as Iraqi oil is concerned, how fast did the awareness of the Iraqi oil reserves and the concern for any sort of control of them come on in the 20s and 30s?
Certainly. It was by the late 1920s that oil began to loom as a commercial issue.
Yes.
But again, I with the 1920s and again with stated, I don't disagree with you, but I'd maybe put a difference of emphasis. That oil is very important, but it isn't the dominant theme in any government's foreign policy. Clearly, strategy, strategic interest, military threat come ahead of economic interest. So I'm not an economic determinist in that sense. That certainly invading Iraq has been very profitable for some of the individuals in the administration's friends in large oil companies around the United States. But the invasion of Iraq was driven forward by, however wrongly we might think of them, but certainly by strategic and political goals held by the Bush administration.
I hope the caller will forgive me for jumping in because the lines are full and I have some other folks who would like to be a part of the conversation. We'll go on, and the next person in line is in Charleston on line four. Hello.
Yes, thank you. Lately I have been thinking in terms of the conservation of natural resources, and in conserving those, the second and third world entities now are to be dominated by the West. And since the capitalism, in my opinion, is in its synthesis, what does that mean? That's the dominating group. The Western capitalism now will not be interested in consuming or distributing natural resources, but will conserve those resources and diminish the population. And the new paradigm for capitalist culture will be a new fascism. And we'll have these few people, which it's almost like that now, who own everything. And the masses of the world have nothing. I'll hang up and listen for your response. And thank you.
All right. Can you comment on that?
Well, it's a very complex and wide-ranging question. I think there are several issues there that I could address. Certainly, you know, the mass majority of the wealth and the mass majority of consumption is focused on the western or northern half of the globe, and the south clearly is not developing as quickly or as straightforwardly as some people in the 1960s and 70s would have predicted. Certainly, I think the caller was also referring to the dominance of the world economy by multinational companies, increasingly monopolizing the exploitation of natural resources in the South, in the developing world. I suppose the question is what one does about that. Clearly, there was, in the immediate aftermath of decolonization, Iraq was at the forefront of this. There was a move to nationalize economic resources, especially in the Middle East, where the main oil companies were nationalized and run by the governments in the name of the populations. Now, that didn't work, as we saw, that although in the Middle East a certain amount of economic development was pushed forward, the nationalizing of oil resources was used by the government as a powerful tool to suppress the populations. Now, we seem to have swung back to the other extreme, a kind of free market fundamentalism that gives much, much more power to multinational companies and international markets than it does to government. I suppose what one would want to see in Iraq, and I doubt if we'll get it, but one would want to see a balance between those two forces, a decentralized ownership of the oil, maybe on a regional basis, on the governorates of Iraq, so ordinary people at the grassroots level could feel they had more ownership, more influence over how oil revenues were spent in Iraq, and then how that money was deployed across the whole of the country.
All right, let's continue to our next caller, Bloomington, Indiana, line two. Hello.
Hi, I haven't been able to listen to all your comments. I hope you haven't already answered my question, but my question is about the fact that at the time that Britain took over in Iraq, Britain had an empire. Britain was an imperial power, and imperialism was respectable in Europe. And any country that was occupied by Britain could reasonably fear that Britain was going to make that country part of the British Empire. It's very different now. I don't think anybody thinks that America wants an empire, and I don't think that anybody thinks that America wants to stay in Iraq one day longer than we want to get out as soon as we reasonably can. Doesn't that change the picture some?
It certainly does, and I agree with you. We're living in radically different historical circumstances, and I go into that in quite a lot of detail in the first chapter of the book. I think what's so fascinating about Iraq in the 1920s, and this is on the basis of American President Woodrow Wilson, that if it hadn't been for the brief ascendancy of President Woodrow Wilson and America's power the immediate aftermath of the First World War, Iraq may well have been annexed to the British Empire, may well have been part of the British Empire, but Wilson very powerfully demanded that it shouldn't be, that imperialism had destabilized the international system, and that the territories seized at the end of the First World War should be overseen by the League of Nations in the name of self-determination and the growth of independent states. And I think that led to decolonization in the aftermath of the Second World War and to where we are today. So I agree with you. The term empire and imperialism may well carry too much historical baggage and weight for it to be applied to the United States today. But conversely, what the United States did when it invaded Iraq was remove a regime that it thought of as its enemy, intervened in a country without an international mandate to change the government of a supposedly sovereign independent entity. Now, that is clearly using powerful military influence to change a regime you don't like. Now, that may well not be imperialism, and I totally agree with you that, especially today, the United States, under the dynamics of the forthcoming presidential elections, may well leave Iraq too early without doing the job it promised to do, which is building a liberal democratic state. But that still doesn't negate the fact that they used overbearing military power to change the government of a supposedly sovereign state.
That's right. May I just make one quick comment? And that is, let's advance our imaginations 50 years and think back. If it's 50 years hence now, and we're thinking back to these days, the one thing that will be remembered about these early years of the 21st century will be that the United States and Britain cooperated in overthrowing a terrible tyranny in Iraq. Now, the weapons of mass destruction will be totally forgotten. Nobody will care about it. But we will remember that Britain and America overthrew this terrible dictatorship and freed these Iraqi people. Is that possible?
It's an excellent point, and I think it goes straight to the future of Iraq. So yes, there's no denying that Saddam Hussein was probably one of the worst tyrants in the world, did absolutely horrible things to his population and destabilized the region, and his removal was welcomed by the Iraqi people. But, and this is the huge but, if we go forward 50 years and we turn around and look back, that removal won't be judged, I suspect, by the removal of the tyranny. It'll be judged by what comes afterwards. Now, clearly, I think it's patently obvious that there was a chronic, if not negligent, lack of planning about what we should do in the aftermath of regime change. What do we do with Iraq after April 9th? And that simply wasn't thought about and isn't going well. The attempt to build a liberal democratic state seems to be being short-circuited, undermined by, understandably but very worryingly, by President Bush's desire to get re-elected and pull American troops out as soon as possible. Now, if that's the case, history may well not judge British and American intentions favorably, because if they don't deliver on the promises, and let us not forget, the promise that George Bush and Tony Blair made to the Iraqi people before the invasion was, we will help you build a stable, liberal, democratic state. Now, if they don't hang about to do that, then historical judgment might be a lot harsher than you suggest. Mm.
I want to come back to one point you just touched on, and it is the question of why it is that the United States seemed so poorly prepared for what happened after the government of Saddam Hussein fell. And I came across an interview that you gave, and I think this was it, with ABC News here in the United States, and this was back in March. So this was before the war happened, around the time that the fighting was going on. And you told the interviewer that you thought that there was a fundamental misconception at the heart of the U.S. strategy, and it ran all the way from the president down through the military. And you said that they, meaning the president and the Pentagon, believe the Iraqi state is highly dictatorial, which it is. They believe the Iraqi state to be run by a tiny group of very ruthless and violent men, which it is. But the third point, they believe the Iraqi nation will welcome them as liberators and see them as doing a good deed for them, which they're not at the moment. I think what they've misunderstood is a tenacious and possibly quite violent nationalism. It's very understandable. These people have gone through two wars and 12 years of crippling sanctions. These people are angry, and that's going to be highly problematic. Now, you said that in March, and it turned out that you were right on the money. And I'm sure that you probably weren't the only person who had that understanding. And I guess the question that I keep coming back to is, why is it that the people in the White House and the Pentagon didn't understand that?
Well, so you've certainly done your research, and thank you for picking one of the more sustained interviews I did before the war. I think there is, and I go into this in great detail in the final chapter of Inventing Iraq, there was a profound misunderstanding at the heart of neoconservatism, at the heart of the lack of planning before the war. Now, clearly, the United States, or certainly key decision makers, believed that Iraq was a very strong state, which it was, but they believed that the institutions of the state were very strong, which they weren't. They believed that once they seized Baghdad, they could rule through these strong state institutions and then slowly reform them. And I think this goes to the heart of Dick Cheney and Donald Rumsfeld's comments that American troops will only be there for 6 months. Now, anyone who'd been to Iraq before the invasion, which I had on several occasions, found two things. One, that you indicated a very powerful nationalism, but two, the fact that 12 years of sanctions, three wars now in the last 20 years, and 3 weeks of looting in the aftermath of regime change had broken the state. There's simply not a nationwide state system in Iraq anymore. Now, the reason for that was under the Tories, these sanctions, the harshest, most efficient sanctions ever imposed on a country, were specifically designed to break state power, and they did that very well. So by the time the Americans get to Baghdad on April 9th, the state that they want to rule through has collapsed. It's disappeared. It's been broken. What Saddam guaranteed his very successful grip on power, successful for his own point because he was never thrown out, by creating a kind of shadow state, a parallel set of informal institutions where he ran money through a flexible network of his friends, people tied to him by region, people tied to him by loyalty, and he strips all of the power out of the state. Now, I was in Iraq in 2001, and I wanted to wanted to go and do some research in possibly the weakest area of Iraq. And it was, I thought, I'll go down to Najaf and Karbala, the Shiite holy cities in the south of Iraq, and I'll interview the governor of this province, you know, the most problematic province for Saddam Hussein. Now, I had to step over a pool of raw sewage outside the governor's office that had come from a broken toilet to actually get in to interview him. I mean, this is indicative of the fact that the institutions of the state were powerless, that they'd been stripped of any power, and Saddam was ruling through a totally separate set of informal structures. So when the United States or the Coalition Provisional Authority went to reach for those institutions to rule Iraq, they disappeared in their hands, and that's the problem that we're seeing now, that the neoconservatives thought they were going to be engaged in a short process of state reformation. What they're actually involved in is a probably generation, 10 or 15 year long process of building a state up from the very grassroots. This has to be understood. If you understand that, then you get to the very bottom of the problems that we're facing in Iraq today.
We have a couple of callers here. I'll get right to them. We're a bit past the midpoint. In fact, we have about 15 minutes left, and maybe just very quickly again for anybody who has just joined us, I'd like to introduce again our guest, Toby Dodge. He's a senior research fellow at the Center for the Study of Globalization at University of Warwick in the UK. He is also an associate fellow of the Royal Institute of International Affairs in London. He's acted as consultant on Iraq for ABC News. He's also written for The Guardian. If you're interested in exploring some of the history of Iraq, particularly this time when the British were involved in the 20s and 30s, you should look for his book, Inventing Iraq. It is published by the Columbia University Press. We have a couple of callers here, and we'll get on to the next, and that would be Urbana, line number 3. Hello.
Yeah, hi. You know, a lot of people have talked about in this war on terror and said, well, you know, the Bush administration is not really and didn't really invade Iraq because of the war on terror. It's just about oil. People have said, well, you know, if you look at Al-Qaeda, a lot of the funding and the sources of organization for Al-Qaeda actually come from these sources in Saudi Arabia, and they've said, well, look at that. You know, obviously that can't be the reason for going into Iraq. But the thing is, if you take a little more complicated view of it, you could argue that, you know, as any American who drives a sport utility vehicle knows, you know, we use a lot of oil. And right now, Saudi Arabia is one of the biggest sources of oil. And so at this point, it would just be very difficult for us to put pressure on Saudi Arabia to deal with that, because they could just, you know, just because we're dependent on them. So if you think about it in terms of oil, you could argue that if we're able to secure Iraq, that can be another source of oil. And that actually reduces our dependence on Saudi Arabia, and so we can just tell them, okay, now we've got Iraq, we've got oil, and we're not as dependent on you. So you could argue that we're actually fighting the war on terrorism, because then we'll be able to tell Saudi Arabia, you need to crack down on those sources of terrorist support.
That's a fascinating and very interesting approach to the question. I tried to deal with oil earlier on in a previous answer, but I certainly agree with you that Al-Qaeda had no contact roots whatsoever within Iraq under Saddam Hussein before April 9th. And certainly a lot of the funding, certainly as we know, the vast majority of the personnel for 9/11 and a lot of the planning came from Saudi Arabia, but clearly not from the Saudi government. The issue that begs from your question begs is that, you know, people really dislike foreigners coming in and running their country, and we've seen that very quickly after April the 9th in Iraq, that, you know, foreign soldiers, whoever they are, however good their intentions are, tend to engender a resentment and tend to be the focus of a nationalist anger. You know, and if you go to Ferdows Square, where the statue of Saddam Hussein was so publicly toppled on April the 9th, around the base of that statue, someone has written both in English and in Arabic, thank you very much, now go home. And I think there is a sense that, and I think the United States realized this, that their presence is a focus for resentment. So now we have a problem. The problem is that clearly Iraq has needs the help over 10, 15 years to build up a stable liberal democratic state, but the United States is becoming the focus of resentment, as the recently leaked CIA report suggests. So what can we do? We couldn't and shouldn't abandon Iraq to its fate. That would be a betrayal of the promises made in the run-up to the war. It would also lead to widespread regional instability. So what we should do, I suspect, is bring in the United Nations, internationalize or multilateralize the occupation of Iraq, therefore bringing in much more expertise, bringing in much more money, bringing in a varied different type of troops, and therefore reducing the resentment that the Iraqi people feel to the United States presence.
All right, so basically that means that at this point you could argue that Iraq, more than anything else, is pretty much just a pawn in this big war that the U.S. is fighting. And, I mean, you can call it a war on terrorism, you can call it a war for oil, but maybe if, you know, taking all the, you know, the doctrine and the ideology out of it, basically, it's really just a war for American security, and if fighting terrorism in Saudi Arabia is required for our security, and if having oil supplies is required for our security, then basically taking out Iraq, getting control of Iraq, gets us oil and gets us more security and ability to put pressure on Saudi Arabia to fight the terrorists. So without saying that it's based on humanitarianism or you know freedom and democracy, you could argue that, and without denying the arguments that it's about empire, you could just say pure and simple it's about American security and just our doing whatever is in our best interest.
Well, let me try this from another perspective. A war against terrorism has to do two things. You know? Firstly, it has to be a multilateral coalition that is global in reach. So you reach out to every other country, convince them it's in their interests to have a united coalition against that. So in doing that, you remove the areas or you shrink radically the areas where terrorists can operate with impunity. Secondly, you shrink the population base to support for terrorism in an area like the Middle East. And I would argue, rather tragically, that the invasion of Iraq has done the opposite of both. If you look around the world and find two governments that are very experienced and very committed to fighting Islamic terrorism, the two at the top of the list are Germany and France. Now, Germany and France were also, as we know now, potent targets of popular opinion in America because they didn't back the invasion of Iraq. They were very, very strong in backing the war against terrorism. So that's one of the negative spin-offs. Secondly, you know, terrorism comes from poverty, as President Bush said in his National Endowment for Democracy speech a couple of weeks ago. It springs out of poverty, it springs out of anger and resentment. Now, if you want to convince the population of the Middle East, where a lot of the terrorism comes from, that you're on its side, you don't invade another country in the region, and you don't stay there long enough for a nationalist resent backlash to come back. So I think the war on terrorism has been undermined by the invasion of Iraq. The invasion of Iraq has been extremely counterproductive in a series of theaters which you would have expected the U.S. to triumph in to win the war on terrorism.
Time is growing short. Again, I hope the caller will forgive me if I go on to the next person here, and that's a caller in Champaign on line number one. Hello.
Hi. You've drawn parallels between the 1920s and the present situation, and I was wondering if you could maybe emphasize that more through the eyes of the people actually of Iraq and how they would see the British and the Americans, but yet how the geopolitical situation has changed. For example, perhaps they were seeing this in terms of Arab nationalism, anti-colonialization, and you know, anti-occupation in the 20s, and how this might relate to, you know, a rejection of Ba'athist nationalism, possibly, and a turn towards an Islamicist nationalism. Do you think that this is turning into a war between Iran, for example, who are backing the Shiites to some extent, and certain Wahhabi groups or other Sunni groups that are backing the Sunnis?
I think there's several extremely good points there. The first one from the popular perspective of ordinary Iraqis. Now, if you think, what is state building about? It's about getting down into society and convincing the population that the institutions that you're building of the state have meaning for their everyday lives, that they own the institutions of the state, give them legitimacy, and are prepared to fight hard to defend them. Now, the British failed in doing that, terribly failed in doing that. They didn't get down into society. They didn't set up institutions that had meaning to everyday Iraqis and therefore legitimacy. My great fear and worry is that the same thing is happening today, that Paul Bremer, the chief civilian administrator in Baghdad, has spent a lot of time and energy setting up the Interim Governing Council, a 24-member body sitting in Baghdad, made up primarily of the exiles that came back into Iraq with the American invasion. Now, in my interviewing in Baghdad in May and June this year, I found deep resentment towards the people that made up that council and an alienation. You know, this council had very little meaning to ordinary Iraqis. They were saying, you know, why are they spending so much time building up this institution full of people who have recently returned to the country? It means nothing to us. So I think that on April 9th, in the immediate aftermath of April 9th, there was an amazing awe that the Americans had managed to change this dictatorial regime so quickly, and there was a lot of goodwill. But since April the 9th, a series of mistakes and inefficiencies by the occupying powers have alienated the Iraqi population, and there is a growing anger at what's seen as the incompetence of occupation. That's the first point. I think your second point, now, anyone who's been to Iraq over the last 5 or 6 years can't help but come across a very powerful Iraqi nationalism. And it's a nationalism that unites certainly the south and center of the country and seems to me to be much stronger than Shia, Sunni, or Kurdish identity. Now, it has to be kept in mind that the Iraq fought the 1980 to 1988 Iran-Iraq war against Iran. I think it's two-thirds of the Iraqi army are Shia. And they fought loyally against their fellow Shia in Iran. Now, they did this not because they liked Saddam Hussein, because they had very good reason to hate him for his oppression and violence. They did this because they were fighting for the Iraqi nation. So I think the kind of popular punditry that says Iraq is equally divided between the Shia, the Sunni, and the Kurds is actually wrong. I think at the moment, and let me stress at the moment, Iraq is a unitary nation with a strong sense of its own identity. That may well change, but at the moment we have something very powerful to work on, a nation that knows itself as such and is very committed to the unitary state in Iraq.
And do you think we were snookered when we came in there and we thought we'd taken the place over? Obviously, there was a plan for people, for the army to withdraw, to kind of disappear, or whatever the word is. It seems to me there was a well laid out plan on the part of Saddam's people to start, you know, a guerrilla war, as the Al Jazeera reporter asked Abu Zayed about, you know, at the time of, you know, the invasion.
I think certainly, I'm not sure that there was a plan, but certainly there were measures taken. I interviewed Tariq Aziz in Baghdad in November 2002, and he was very explicit about it. He said, you know, when the Americans come to Baghdad, they'll find ghosts. All our people would have disappeared. They set up a series of arms dumps across the country. They decentralized command and control, gave local generals local power. So I'm not sure that the United States is snookered, but I think the United States, and this has always been my fear, and I've written about this in the run-up to the war quite a lot, I always felt the United States had underestimated the military power of the old regime. Clearly, they won very quickly and mercifully, but with comparatively few loss of lives. But now those forces are coming back in a much more asymmetrical way to haunt the United States. And listening to people like Donald Rumsfeld, who was interviewed a couple of Sundays ago after the tragic loss of that Chinook, there doesn't seem to be any strategic answer to what you do about this. I mean, the use of air power, the use of bombing and helicopter gunships, strikes me as very counterproductive, because it's clearly apparent that the United States Army hasn't got the fine-grained intelligence, the on-the-ground political intelligence, to target these people effectively by troops, let alone by air power at 2,000 feet. So I think United States occupation, when faced with this violence, is making up policy on the hoof. It's making up policy in a very reactive, short-term way, and that can only destabilize what they're involved in, which hopefully would be, if successfully carried out, the creation of a liberal democratic state. Mm.
We're just about the point we have to stop. I would like to ask the question, what should the United States do? And I guess I will, but I can only give you about a minute to give me an answer.
I think it's unfair for any one country to be asked to devote the troops, money, and expertise over 15 years to build the Iraqi state, to help the Iraqis build a liberal democratic state. And clearly the United States, in the run-up to a presidential election, is in no mood to commit that time and money. So I think to deliver on President Bush and Prime Minister Blair's promises to the Iraqi people, we need to give this back to the United Nations. We need to multilateralize and make it a United Nations occupation, a United Nations attempt at state building. If we don't do that, I think that there's great danger that history will repeat itself, and that the occupation won't build a liberal democratic state. And if we fail in doing that, Iraq will once again become the center of regional instability, and the Iraqi state will once again use high levels of violence and corruption to control its own population.
Well, there we must stop. For people, again, who are interested in reading more on the history of the British involvement there and how it may indeed relate to where we are now, you can look for the book we've talked about, Inventing Iraq. It is published by Columbia University Press, by our guest, Toby Dodge, Senior Research Fellow at the Center for the Study of Globalization, University of Warwick in England. And Dr. Dodge, thank you very much for talking with us.
It was a pleasure. Thank you.